Survival of the Richest, now on A View from the Bunker. The biggest news stories of the last month or so have been the social upheaval in Iran and the ongoing economic upheaval here in the United States and abroad. Are these isolated incidents or are these examples of socio-political engineering? Our guests will talk about that now. The authors of The Ascendancy of Scientific Dictatorship and regular contributors to the Illuminati Conspiracy Archive online. We welcome back Paul and Philip Collins. Guys, it's good to talk with you again.
Thank you, Derek. Thanks so much, Derek.
Your recent article at the Conspiracy Archive, Survival of the Richest, deals with the so-called stimulus package that's been passed by the United States Congress and how the money's being used. And you begin with an incident that hits real close to where you guys live, the decision by National Cash Register to abandon Dayton, Ohio after 125 years. Why did NCR decide to leave Dayton? Where are they going?
Well, evidently, now there's a lot of controversy surrounding NCR's departure. A lot of hearsay and politics as usual. If you believe what Governor Strickland and what Mayor McClinn of Dayton have said, what several other people, local officials, elected officials have said, NCR simply after they Bill Nudy became their CEO, simply had no interest in staying in Dayton, and that they just weren't carrying on regular public discourse with the community, and they had basically resigned themselves to the decision to leave and go to Georgia several months, if not years, years in advance. If you believe what NCR has been saying, NCR would have you believe that they had made their intentions known, and that Dayton just simply was not offering enough incentives to stay. And you know, in the case of this little controversy, I can see where you know either side might be correct, because NCR being a Fortune 500 company, Fortune 500 companies, not to make a gross generalization, but they tend to be somewhat indifferent. And yes, NCR was born in Dayton, but you know, evidently the company feels no allegiance whatsoever to its own birthplace, to its own natal community, and so. You know, I can see where one could cite corporate indifference, but there's also very compelling evidence to suggest that Dayton was, in fact, not offering them enough incentives to stay here. Ohio's business climate is not the most healthiest. They tax the living daylights out of businesses here, especially since the manufacturing sector was eviscerated with NAFTA and GATT and free trade agreements being fully implemented. Now what businesses remain are feeling the socioeconomic pressure of that evisceration, because in order to compensate for the lack of tax revenue, cities and municipalities are in fact increasing their taxes on the businesses. So,
which encourages more businesses to leave, and it's
exactly
a vicious cycle.
Exactly. And this state has not been one of the most fiscally conservative states. This state has always gravitated towards high taxes. It's always gravitated towards more intervention federal intervention, more state intervention in the marketplace, which is problematic because that can create, you know, all sorts of problems from a lack of freedom in terms of business, and also it can also lead to state sanctioned monopolies. But at any rate, NCR is in fact leaving, and as a matter of fact has begun to dismantle its operations this month. Starting this month, NCR's worldwide headquarters will be moving to Duluth in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And the company will also be transplanting its manufacturing operation in Columbus, Georgia.
How many jobs will the Dayton area lose because of this move?
2,100.
2,100 jobs. Wow.
I'm sorry?
Just wow. I mean, that's a lot of folks.
That's a lot of jobs. Well, NCR was a major catalyst for growth here, was a major job supplier. So, you know, we're talking, you know, over 2,000 jobs gone now. So, but at any rate, while there was shock and there was dismay over NCR leaving. Oh, and by the way, at the last minute, our esteemed Governor Strickland decided to offer the company $31.7 million incentive package, which proved to be too little, too late, because the Georgia officials were offering NCR a $60 million plus incentive package. but the shock and the outrage over this, you know, over NCR's sudden move. Was compounded by the by revelations that Georgia was going to use $5 million as part of its overall incentive package to basically lure NCR away, and basically they were going to use the $5 million of stimulus money to purchase a building for a plant to accommodate NCR's forthcoming manufacturing operation. Now,
so to emphasize that point, this $5 million was coming from Georgia's share of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus package passed by the United States Congress?
Yes, yes, $5 million. Now, there have been arguments over the question of whether or not the use of the $5 million actually did lead to NCR's final decision to leave. Some people have been saying that the incentive package offered by Georgia, being as large as it was, would have compelled NCR to leave anyways, with or without stimulus monies. However, that is completely and totally inconsequential. I don't care if it's $5 million or $5.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that stimulus money, federal stimulus money, is constituted by taxpayer money. Now, you do the math. If stimulus money is being used to finance the relocation of NCR to Georgia, then who is going to be footing the bill? Ohio taxpayers.
Sure.
So Ohio taxpayers are, in essence, subsidizing the relocation of one of their own businesses. They are basically paying NCR to leave and to take with it 2,100 jobs.
you would not pay your spouse's mistress, nor would you pay the hitman that has a contract to knock you off, and yet that's what this is comparable to.
Yeah.
And presumably then more stimulus money will have to be used to try to create 2,000 more jobs in the Dayton area.
Yeah.
To solve the problem created by
we addressed that issue in the article because you're starting a very, very vicious cycle with this. But I interviewed Senator John Husted and Congressman Mike Turner for this article. And at one point, John Husted said, quote, "We know about this being the use of stimulus money to lure NCR away from Dayton. We know about this, but how many other cases are there in this country where we are allowing one state to outbid another state for jobs that already exist? How many hundreds of millions in stimulus dollars could be wasted doing this kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
It's unconscionable. In Ohio, we used our stimulus money to balance the budget, but other states that aren't in our situation are apparently using their dollars to basically buy businesses that exist in other states," unquote. So Houston's question is indeed a disturbing one. Just how many other states have already used stimulus monies to curry favor with corporations? How many have followed the Georgia example? And if there has been prolific use of stimulus money already to essentially court out-of-state businesses and basically relocate already existing jobs, then corporate interest stand to be the chief beneficiaries of the federal stimulus program. Thus, the economy is not what's being stimulated. All that is being stimulated is corporate interest. If stimulus money is being used by states to court corporations, then taxpayer dollars are being used to subsidize the relocation of already existing jobs. Now, such a state of affairs, it cannot qualify as economic growth. You don't have infrastructure being built.
Right.
In fact, infrastructure is just being displaced. And the fiscal stimulus, which is constituted by taxpayer dollars, is only stimulating big business. And so in this sense, what you see taking place is not economic recovery, but the use of an economic or an ostensible economic recovery program to basically create a conduit for an enormous wealth transfer from the American taxpayer to corporate interest. Simultaneously, what you have is a social Darwinian climate where basically states must use stimulus funds as weapons in a struggle for economic survival.
We like to refer to it as Thunderdome economics.
Yeah, Thunderdome economics. For those who I'm sure that
I'm sure there's a few Gibson fans in the audience, and
they know how the
sport, quote unquote, loosely using that term, of Thunderdome went.
Sure. Yeah, essentially, with the Thunderdome model, of course, you had two people basically paraded into a dome, suspended from wires, and then forced to basically leap from those wires to weapons hanging from the ceilings, grab those weapons before their opponents could, and use them to chop them off at the knees. Essentially, in this instance, the stimulus package becomes analogous to the weapons hanging from the ceiling of Thunderdomes, and the states are the ones suspended from wires.
Right.
And basically the states have to attempt to gain as much stimulus money as they can to basically outbid their opponents and basically cut their opponents off at the knees and leave them to fend for themselves in a very social Darwinian fashion.
So to paraphrase the Queen of Soul, two states enter, one state leaves.
Yeah. So now, go ahead, continue.
Oh, no. Well, essentially, the biggest question, though, that arose when I was examining this situation, because this began as an article for a local paper, was what if the stimulus package? I mean, of course, there have been stimulus missteps, and Ohio has had more than her fair share of stimulus missteps. For instance, there was the use of $1.2 million to basically save the jobs of Columbus police recruits, who, as it turns out, will probably be laid off anyway in 2010. There was also the allocation of $1.1 million to treat groundwater at the Cold War era RMI extrusion plant, and that was ruled already safe in 2007.
So they're going to
also the creation of a $57 million slush fund to finance the study, not the actual execution of the study of projects that will probably never be constructed, all with stimulus money. And all of these missteps have cost Ohio taxpayers dearly. But
so when they're talking about shovel-ready projects, I think we're getting a pretty good sense of the kind of material that these shovels were actually shoveling.
Yeah. Well, if you can smell some of what they're shoveling at you.
That's exactly what I mean, yes.
Exactly. But the big question that I started to ask was, what if the stimulus package was in fact designed to operate in just such a fashion? Well, that question starts becoming more palatable when one examines the ideological pedigree of Nancy Pelosi.
Yes.
Nancy Pelosi, of course, the stimulus plan was pinned in her office, was mm-hmm. actually written in her office, and rushed to a vote only 12 hours after being written in her office, with not a single lawmaker looking at the bill.
So, which seems to be commonplace nowadays on the Hill.
Well, Pelosi's obscurantist proclivities, they persist, as is evidenced with the health care plan, because she did not want lawmakers to see the health care plan either.
Or, of course, the cap and trade bill, which was written so quickly, they actually left one section open as with a placeholder in it that said section reserved for legislation to be inserted after the bill was voted on.
After it was signed.
Yeah. Certainly.
And isn't that great? Just, you know,
trust us.
Sign on
we
the
know
line
what we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll fill in the rest later. You
mm-hmm.
know.
But unbelievable.
So evidently, Pelosi is exhibiting some distinct obscurantist proclivities. Now, when one examines Pelosi's ideological pedigree, the reason for her obscurantism becomes a little bit clearer. Pelosi, while she was delivering a commencement address at the North Campus of Miami-Dade College,
mm-hmm.
Invoked the phrase "novus ordo seclorum." Now, this phrase was invoked by the adherents of the so-called Promethean faith, which included the early Romantics, the young Marx, that is Karl Marx, and the Russians of Lenin's time. Out of the Promethean faith would come all socialist revolutionary movements of both the communist and fascist ilk.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but why the name Promethean?
Good question. The Promethean faith, basically, and that term is examined by James Billington in his excellent book, Fire in the Minds of Men. The Promethean faith basically venerated the mythic character of Prometheus,
mm-hmm.
Holding that man was analogous to Prometheus. Of course, Prometheus stole fire from the gods and gave it to man.
Mm-hmm.
And Prometheus basically represented man's ability to facilitate his own salvation through his own cognitive powers. And that, of course, is the doctrine of self-salvation, which most astute listeners will recognize as an occult doctrine that came from Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that all subsequent socialist revolutionary movements, all the socio-political utopian movements that came out of the Enlightenment were basically the results of the result of a codification of Gnostic occult doctrine as a revolutionary doctrine, as a revolutionary ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Prometheus shares the paradigmatic character with none other than Lucifer.
Sure.
Who, of course, rebelled against God, and also basically told man that he could become God.
Right.
Basically achieve apotheosis through his own cognitive powers.
With the Enlightenment, the two would almost become interchangeable, actually, with Denis Diderot actually placing a picture of Lucifer on the encyclopedia.
Yeah, on the encyclopedia, which was the official Bible of the Enlightenment. But the Promethean faith also held that science was essentially the new lantern of salvation that would lead man out of darkness and into light. And again, this constituted a form of secular Gnosticism, as is evidenced by its parallels with traditional Gnosticism's doctrine of self-salvation. But it also constitutes vintage scientism,
mm-hmm.
that is the fetishization of science, the belief that science should be universally imposed upon all fields of inquiry. And, of course, such a universal imposition, while it's considered desirable by the modern mind, chronocentric as it is, such a universal imposition is very, very dangerous, because science is predominantly a system of quantification, and it concerns itself predominantly with quantifiable entities and with empirically demonstrable entities. And thus, all things that fall outside its ambit, all things that are not quantifiable or not empirically demonstrable, are automatically precluded. And that includes concepts such as liberty, dignity, the value, the intrinsic sanctity of human life. All these things defy quantification. They're not quantifiably and empirically demonstrable.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, the scientific worldview must jettison them entirely. Now,
one of the very first things that I read by you that really impressed me as an astute observation, and I believe this is from the Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, but correct me if I'm wrong, was that science and its adherents, by denying that that which cannot be quantified must therefore not exist. And while they would claim that they are strictly secular, many of them, in their approach, that in itself, that which I cannot measure does not exist, is a metaphysical claim.
It is a metaphysical claim, and as such, it qualifies as a religion. In fact, anybody who would have you believe that their worldview is completely and totally bereft of any religious character is lying. Because all worldviews must proffer a metaphysical claim. Metaphysical claims are traditionally the province of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at, for instance, radical empiricism, and I don't want to get too far afield, but radical empiricism, which constituted the epistemological core of scientism and of the Promethean faith, was demonstrated by David Hume, who himself was an Enlightenment thinker, leads to a rejection of causality. In other words, cause and effect relationships no longer exist. You can demonstrate temporal succession, that is, two phenomena occurring one after the other in a definite succession. And you can demonstrate spatial proximity, that mm-hmm. is, two phenomena occurring near or in the same vicinity as one another, but you cannot demonstrate actual causal connection between the two. And so what it might be construed as A causing B might actually just be an instance of circumstantial juxtaposition. And so essentially, causality is completely jettisoned, and there's only probability. And so really all of scientists' findings, which ironically seek to affirm cause and effect relationships, must be taken upon faith. And that therein lies the rub. And so whenever those of the scientistic worldview would have you believe that Christians are operating on blind faith, that is, in fact, not true. Their own epistemology stipulates a certain degree of faith. And
mm-hmm.
By the way, the word for faith in the New Testament was the Greek word pistis, which was also invoked by none other than Aristotle, who himself was interested in the physical sciences. And the word pistis connotes forensic proof, connotes physical evidence. And one of the first apologias offered by Peter, makes three evidentiary claims. This is, of course, in the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
He cites the empty tomb. He cites the miracles and signs and wonders of Jesus. Now, all of his claims are evidentiary claims. They're
right.
premised on evidence. So this nonsense that Christians or those with traditional theistic notions are completely and totally relying on blind faith is absolutely flatly bogus.
Yeah.
In fact, the scientific worldview is equally premised on a certain degree of faith, and they just substitute in the place of faith, they substitute the word probability. But returning to the Promethean faith and
mm-hmm.
its veneration for science and scientism, the fetishization of science, the universal imposition of science for the socialist revolutionaries who adhered to the Promethean faith, the universal imposition of science included the realm of governance. And hence you have the emergence of what's known as scientific totalitarianism,
mm-hmm.
Also exemplified by Marx's scientific socialism. This is essentially a situation where science is imposed upon the field of governance. It's basically imposed upon the questions of politics and questions of governance. And in such a state of affairs, the citizen becomes little more than an amalgam of behavioral repertoires whose every thought, feeling, and idea is the product of external stimuli. And from the scientific vantage point, the populace's motivations can be calculated and systematized, thereby allowing those few conditioners, as C.S. Lewis calls them, those few conditioners who are accountable to absolutely no moral master, to develop economic and technological stimuli that will be used to produce the desired patterns of behavior. And this societal model, Aldous Huxley called it the scientific dictatorship in Brave New World. It's also been known as technocracy. Mm-hmm. And technocracy, as defined by Frank Fisher, who wrote the book Technocracy, The Politics of Expertise, which I would recommend to all of the listeners out there. Technocracy, in classical political terms, basically connotes a system of governance where technically trained experts rule by virtue of their specialized knowledge, and these policy professionals are positioned in the dominant economic and political institutions. Now, the technocratic theory also strongly influenced the Marxist concept of a planned economy, in particular the technocratic concept of the administrative state, which originated with Henri de Saint-Simon, who, in a brief caveat, it's interesting to note, was the mentor of none other than Auguste Comte, who was the founding father of the social sciences. And the social sciences, of course, factor in heavily with later with the development of psychological war stratagems by the early OSS, and the which was the forerunner to the CIA.
Hmm.
But the Marxist concept of a planned economy was strongly informed by technocratic theory. Technocratic theory was basically made to order because it legitimized centralized bureaucratic decision-making systems that most socialist regimes actually employed to direct them. And it aligned itself very, very comfortably with the techniques and ideas of scientific planning, and particularly those espoused by Marxist economists. So technocratic concepts basically played an enormous role in the development of socialist theory and practice. But it's interesting to note that here in the United States, we saw the an early instance of technocratic restructuring with none other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And with the New Deal, an early technocratic theoretician in 1932 by the name of Henry A. Porter published a book called Roosevelt and Technocracy. And that book basically raised an interesting question. It asked, will technocracy be the New Deal? And based on Porter's observations, he gravitated towards the affirmative. In fact, Porter really made no bones about his approval of FDR and FDR's New Deal. He said, quote, only skillful statesmanship, the statesmanship of Roosevelt, and sound economic principles, the principles of technocracy, can lead us out of the valley of chaos and despair into which we are plunging, unquote. Now, interestingly enough, we mentioned earlier, Pelosi invoked the phrase novus ordo seclorum.
And not for the first time at that commencement address, by the way. She used that very phrase in the speech she delivered upon being inaugurated becoming the first female Speaker of the House in United States history back in January of 2007. In fact, we touched on that in a PID radio program that day, and I may interpolate a clip from that speech, because that phrase jumped out at us in that speech. Was not aware that she had delivered this that phrase in another speech more recently. So this is a recurring idea or meme to Nancy Pelosi.
Right. Now, Billington, James A. Billington, makes clear in his book, Fires in the Minds of Men, the phrase novus ordo seclorum accompanied symbol on the Great Seal, which mm-hmm. was the all-seeing eye atop the pyramid. Now, I want to make something absolutely crystal clear. That symbol did not mean for the American revolutionaries what it meant for the Promethean revolutionaries, for those of the sociopolitical utopian heritage of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. As any semiotician can tell you, the connotative meaning of symbols and of signs is arbitrary, and it's largely based upon subjective interpretations. Now, that's not to say that we're somehow rejecting existence of objective truth. However, it is to say that in terms of signs, in terms of symbols, in terms of language, meaning is largely arbitrary. And according to James Billington, he says, quote, "The ideal was not the balanced complexity of the new American Federation, but the occult simplicity of its Great Seal," unquote. Now, what was the overall reality that the Promethean revolutionaries were seeking to instantiate? Well, evidently, it was a socialist totalitarian model. They were seeking to, in the words of Eric Voegelin, immanentize the eschaton, mm-hmm. that is, bring the end of days into the ontological confines of the physical universe, realize heaven on earth. And they believed that the only way to tangibly approximate that is to instantiate a socialist totalitarian model of governance.
What's really interesting is that this government headed by Barack Obama, and during the Clinton administration, both have issued reports accusing conservative Christians, fundamentalist Christians, in their view, of trying to immanentize the eschaton by, you know, through violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know what? They wouldn't be entirely wrong there if you consider dominionist really genuine Christians.
Well, that's very true. That's very true.
You know, so what they were probably doing was they were probably citing some very legitimate cases of evangelical Wahhabists here in the West. Who ironically, while they reject the Enlightenment, they actually embrace its principles.
Right.
And basically, they just qualify as nothing more than just another variant of neo-Gnostic jihadist.
And the sad thing is that many well-meaning and well-intended Christians who are understandably disturbed by the corporatist tendencies of our government and his liberal bent on social issues may be driven toward the dominionist camp simply because they appear to be more in line theologically with the beliefs of biblical Christians.
Right, right. But at any rate, so we essentially have this the phrase novus ordo seclorum, mm-hmm. and the sign of the all-seeing eye atop the truncated pyramid, which constituted the Great Seal. The Great Seal was actually placed on the dollar bill, the $1 bill, in 1935,
mm-hmm.
and it was placed on the dollar bill by a 32nd degree Freemason by the name of Henry Wallace, and Henry Wallace was doing so at the behest of FDR, who was also a 32nd degree Freemason. Now, another disclaimer I want to throw out there: the Masonic pedigree of these individuals is important not because we are saying that that there has been some sort of conspiratorial continuity mm-hmm. within the Masonic Lodge, but because after the Enlightenment reached its very bloody nadir with the French Revolution, Masonic political activism, by and large, seem to decline. But most lodges were relatively benign organizations after that. However, the fire in the minds of men, as Dostoevsky called it, still pervaded some strains of Freemasonry, as is evidenced by the Knights of the Golden Circle, which played a significant role in agitating the Civil War, and also the P2 Lodge in Italy. So evidently, these Masons that peopled FDR's administration adhered to some variant of the revolutionary faith, of the Promethean faith. And Wallace placed the Great Seal on American currency because he believed that America was arriving at this pivotal juncture in her history, and that enormous spiritual changes were imminent. And he believed that the 1930s would represent a time when there would be this great spiritual awakening, this enormous paradigm shift, and that paradigm shift would basically precede the amalgamation of all nation states into a single one world state, which from his socio-political utopian view would constitute heaven on earth.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, so you have the instantiation of a technocracy, the entrenchment of a technocracy here, or well, the technocratic restructuring of the American system here during the 30s under FDR's administration. And of course, with the semiotically communicated by the placement of the all-seeing eye upon American currency, and accompanying that iconography was the phrase "Novus Ordo Seclorum,"
mm-hmm.
which brings us back to Pelosi. Pelosi invoked that phrase during her commencement address, and so this the invocation of that phrase seems to hint at a certain ideological pedigree that Pelosi comes from, and this might explain her obscurantist proclivities and the purposes that she had for seeing to it that this stimulus bill was rushed into a vote with no lawmakers being able to see it.
In other words, this is a continuation of what was begun with FDR.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For her.
But our basic contention is that Pelosi has been associated with socialists of both the fascist and the communist ilk.
We even hit upon that pedigree that she has there mm-hmm. in the article. We talk about how her family has been extremely close with the Newsom family. William Alfred Newsom III's third was the patriarch, I guess, of the current. You could consider him kind of a patriarch of the current
mm-hmm.
Newsom dynasty. He was a retired state appeals court judge and father of the current mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom. I believe he might still be alive, but Gavin Newsom, people might recognize because of just some of the outrageous social changes that he's brought about in San Francisco, including his strident support of homosexuality, of the normalization, not just the tolerance, but the normalization of that form of lifestyle, putting it on par with heterosexual life,
yeah,
with
traditional marriage, yeah,
exactly. And the Newsom family is Gavin Newsom also has launched. He launched in 2002 a universal health care plan called Healthy San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Which he wanted to see duplicated across the country, which is basically universal health care, not unlike what the Clintons were trying to have
mm-hmm.
Installed when Bill Clinton was the president. He had San Francisco join in kind of a symbolic gesture, the Kyoto Treaty, mm-hmm. the Kyoto Protocol, which most listeners would recognize as an agreement that would seriously destroy the progress of industrialized nations in the name of of reduction of greenhouse gases, and the whether or not greenhouse gases cause any kind of global warming or have any kind of significant impact on climate change is highly controversial. There's a lot of evidence to show that that, in fact, is not the case.
Right.
And, you know, but this is how things have been done for a long time with the elites. They seem to try to get these kind of changes passed through under the pretext of saving the environment. And
in that sense, it's almost like a modern day analog of the medieval king's appeal to their divine right to rule. Now we've got the technocrats appealing to their scientific, or to Gaia's right to rule, which plays a lot better in our modern new agey society.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it looks better when your oligarchy is disguised as a kind of dictatorship of the proletariat, when it's disguised as something that exists for the man on the lower end of the totem pole, and exists for the preservation of the planet. Then all of a sudden, it almost has a benevolent kind of veneer to it. It has a benevolent exterior, and one has to dig deeper to see some of those more nefarious aspects.
Sure.
So she's tied to the Newsom family, who are very much socialist in nature. But Pelosi and the Newsom family both share a common benefactor, and that would be the Hallinan family. And the Hallinan dynasty was very much involved in the Progressive Party, especially when Henry Wallace, who was FDR's vice president, I believe, when he ran for president on the Progressive bill. And the Progressive Party, it should be noted, was considered to be something of a stealth communist party here in the United States. The Communist Party USA, as a matter of fact, they didn't even put up a candidate when Henry Wallace ran on the Progressive ticket. They just backed Wallace because they saw all the planks their political platform being carried out by Wallace, and Wallace was very much against purging any of the communists from the ranks of the Progressive Party, and when he was called upon to do so, he refused, and that's what many people believe led to him losing the election ultimately. But the Hallinans were very much involved with the Progressive Party at that time. They have been known to be supportive of Ortega in Nicaragua and supportive of Castro in Cuba, both considered to be communist countries. Both of those individuals considered to be communist leaders in the communist world, although they have, I know, both tried to downplay that and make themselves look like something of populist, but that's something that the communists like to do, is they play themselves up as populist heroes fighting for the common man. And this is basically her pedigree. She comes from this very extremist background and this very extremist heritage that she possesses with individuals like the Hallinans, like the Newsoms, and even there might be a few Nazis thrown in there, because we know that Newsom worked for TCI, and which was a high-tech computer firm. And he was associated at TCI with an individual by the name of Otto von Bolschwing, and Otto von Bolschwing was known to be a Nazi. He had been part of the Nazis in was one of the individuals that made it into the post-war Nazi infrastructure. One of them, one of the ones that actually escaped the Nuremberg trials, and so, you know, these are the kind of individuals that actually informed her thinking and shaped the way that and shaped her ideology, and so we believe that that's what basically. These were the ideas that were motivating her and energizing her when it came to putting together this bill and many others, the healthcare bill, probably in all likelihood, and all the other kinds of
the climate
of
change bill and so forth. Yeah,
absolutely. All now, of these different pieces of legislation that are coming down the block.
You have this radical now turned statesman, or well, stateswoman, if that's what you want to call her. Because strikes me as being twice the man I am, but at any rate, again, it bears repeating that the federal stimulus package was pinned in her office, and it's important again to note that the stimulus bill was rushed to a vote without being reviewed by a single lawmaker.
Right
now,
actually, may I throw in a quick correction? Helen did not. Fund both Pelosi and the Newsom family. It was an individual by the name of Gordon Getty. Hallinan was more of the left-wing socialist influence on Pelosi. Getty was more of the right-wing. It's through Getty that we find the possible influence of Otto von Bolschwing on Pelosi's thinking.
Getty as in Getty Oil, J. Paul Getty?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, this is the J. Paul Getty was the son of the oil tycoon, Gordon Getty, and it was through J. Gordon Getty that we would find the influence of Otto von Bolschwing, because J. Paul Getty was a director of TCI, which is the Sacramento technological firm that Otto von Bolschwing found himself working for after the war. In I believe it was 1969 that he came to work for that company, and he worked with Newsom while he was at that company. The old man Newsom, William Newsom.
Certainly.
Now,
the big question then is, given these strange confluences, and by the way, for those who tend to think that such confluences are paradoxical, because Pelosi evidently has associated with both fascist and communist.
You're getting to the question I was just about to ask. What's the difference?
The answer is really virtually none. The communists and fascists are really just competing varieties of socialist. In fact, fascism is socialism with a capitalist veneer. Both communists and fascists adhere to the political doctrine of collectivism. That becomes demonstrable in the very etymology of the two systems. So you look at the word communism, it's derived from the Latin root communis, which means group. And you look at the Italian word fascio, from which we derive the word fascism, and that also means group. And both systems are forms of coercive group living, where the individual is subordinated to the collective. The only real substantial difference is that fascism attempts to accomplish what communism does through official cartels. Basically by controlling all aspects of commerce, finance, agriculture, and manufacturing. You basically have planning boards who set up product lines and set up prices, wages, working conditions, production levels, and the size of firms. And you have ubiquitous licensing. There's not a single economic activity that can be undertaken without government permission. There's the state dictating the levels of consumption. Excess incomes are basically surrendered as loans or taxes. Essentially, there's only ostensible private property ownership under fascism, and that's ostensible given the fact that under fascism, it's all susceptible to rigid governmental regulation. Communism, it's fairly transparent governmental ownership and regulation.
Mm.
So there's really the dialectical commonalities. The dialectical commonalities are fairly transparent. Both are forms of collectivism. Both are forms of statism, of monopoly statism.
And so Pelosi could have on the left side Hallinan informing her thinking, and then she could have on the right side Getty and Otto von Bolschwing and Newsom kind of informing her thinking, but she actually saw no no conflict between the two, and you know, and could see a meeting of the minds in herself and in her political activism, because she at least on some level, maybe on a subconscious level, recognizes that there's little no difference between those two variants of Marxism either.
Yeah. And to give you another example, you can have a populist community organizer like Barack Obama, primarily financed by the Wall Street bankers, who are supposed to be these evil fascist Republicans, and yet spent a lot more money on his campaign than they did on John McCain's.
Well, if you look into the background of FDR, you find dynasties such as the Harrimans. You find the Delano clan. Of course, that's where he derived his middle name from, which were part of the Boston Brahmins, these families that basically became junior partners in running opium for the British Empire. really, Barack Obama seems to be the second coming, or they desire at least to make him the second coming of FDR, as a matter of fact. Time Magazine article, the front cover of Time Magazine kind of captured this.
Yeah, the November 24th, 2008 edition of Time Magazine featured Obama wearing FDR's characteristic fedora and clenching FDR's familiar cigarette holder in his teeth. And the cover dubbed Obama's economic recovery plan, quote, the New Deal, unquote. Mm-hmm. And such comparisons have prompted a considerable amount of concern among fiscal conservatives who justifiably contend that FDR's New Deal gave rise to an American form of monopoly statism.
Mm-hmm.
In support of this contention, fiscal conservatives cite the cartelization of the farm sector under the Agricultural Adjustment Act and the formation of technocratic boards or committees to arbitrate distribution prices, wages, production, and all employment conditions. Now, historically, such a marriage between big government and big business has been called corporatism, which Benito Mussolini believed to be embodied by fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Chronicles magazine foreign affairs editor, I can't even pronounce the fellow's name, but he basically makes a very compelling case for such parallels being drawn between FDR's New Deal and Benito's corporatism, citing the policy professionals that surrounded FDR, which were all quite transparently preoccupied with the variety of corporatism that was implemented by Mussolini in Italy. At the time, however, fascism was not considered a pejorative term. Now, of course, that was then, and this is now. Today, corporatism is viewed far less benignly, much to the chagrin of the present administration. Many political commentators contend that a corporatist thread runs throughout Barack's ARRA. For instance, Real Clear Markets writer Steve Malenga has characterized Obama's recovery plan as a return to corporatism, citing the president's appointment of industrial overseers to guide General Motors' future moves as one case in point. And it's also interesting to note that this coterie of industrial overseers really also underscores the technocratic thread that runs throughout all these varieties of socialism, through corporatism, through fascism, through communism. The concept of the administrative state, that technocratic concept developed by Henri de Saint-Simon, heavily informed the socialist worldview. And so that's what we saw entrenched in the United States during the Great Depressions. And that is what I believe we're seeing now. For instance, in my interview with Congressman Mike Turner, who, by the way, is a Republican, and mm-hmm. I am not, although I do appreciate a lot of the man's insights, and I do think that the man is genuinely concerned, he stated that with the government being so deeply entrenched in private industry, there's a real danger of all decisions regarding the marketplace becoming politicized. And the congressman cited the situation with GM as a case in point. He said, I'll quote him for the audience. He said, quote, "Now we're in a situation where we, the government, own General Motors, but we don't own Ford. Mm-hmm. If General Motors and Ford bid on a government contract, I can't imagine how Ford would believe that the government wouldn't have bias toward dealing with itself.
Right.
If General Motors is bidding, it is, in fact, the government bidding. So you're going to have a situation where the government is making conflict of interest decisions that will affect the market," unquote. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're dealing with a very real potential for state-sanctioned monopolies.
And you know what, Derek, back during the Bush administration, we had a lot of talk about exit strategy with mm-hmm. Iraq. You remember,
right.
There's no exit strategy, and that was justifiably so. The problem is that we see this kind of hypocrisy and this double standard, because here we have government intrusion into the private sector now under Barack Obama with no exit strategy being delineated in any of the legislation. When does government leave? When does government step away from GM and take the training wheels off?
Yeah, we have no sunset clause. We have absolutely no sunset clause on this state of affairs.
Is that by design?
That's exactly what we think.
Yep.
Given the ideological pedigree of these individuals. Now, another corollary of this system that we see being established, here in the United States, using the economic downturn, the recession, the depression, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
As a pretext, we see again as a very cutthroat social Darwinian situation starting to take shape. Presently, 48 states are facing shortfalls in their budgets,
mm-hmm.
and simultaneously, several of these states are seeking to curry favor with companies so that they can bring jobs and tax revenue to their respective regions. Yet, because of their deficits, they can't offer incentive packages like Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So given this distinct disadvantage, there is a definite possibility that some states will be tempted to use stimulus money to bid for already existing jobs, citing NCR as a legal justification, as a legal precedent.
Mm.
And herein is the social Darwinian aspect of this entire state of affairs that we see coming into being. Congressman Mike Turner has basically told me that he feared that there was an emerging elitism amongst the states, that there would be this adversarial relational dynamic promulgated amongst the states, and only those states that were wealthy enough to afford jobs would thrive, and those that were not would be left to fend for themselves. Hence, we have to return to the very title of the article, Survival of the Richest. This is vintage social Darwinism. Social Darwinism basically came into being when Herbert Spencer made the speculative extrapolation of evolutionary theory into the realm of economics, into the marketplace, into sociology. Now, several evolutionists, neo-Darwinians, secular humanists tried to argue that this was just an ugly concretion, that this was just something extraneous, social Darwinism, and that Darwin himself was a little bit leery about Herbert Spencer's speculative extrapolation of evolutionary theory into the realm of sociology and in economics. However, Darwin's own notebooks do not bear out that contention. Darwin's notebooks basically make plain that in the end, free trade, imperialism, competition, racial extermination, sexual inequality, all these terrible, terrible things are intrinsic to the equation from the very start. Darwin's notebook is filled with talk of colonial warfare, of genocide, and Darwin embraced savage, unregulated competition and free trade, which are two pillars of modern monopolistic capitalism. So evidently, Darwin was not so wary of Spencer's speculative extrapolation into the sociological. And to further support this contention, I would submit to you the case of Harriet Martineau, who was one of Darwin's dinner guests. Martineau was a sociologist and a Comtean sociocrat. As I mentioned earlier, Henri de Saint-Simon was the mentor of Auguste Comte, who founded the social sciences, which underscores the technocratic origins of sociology. But she was an adherent of Comte's teachings, and she wrote a book called Poor Laws and Paupers Illustrated, and it was recommended to Darwin by his sisters. And evidently, I guess, Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who, by the way, was a supporter of the radical Jacobins in revolutionary France and a member of a technocratic enclave, technocratic enclave known as the Lunar Society, which was the precursor to the British Royal Society. He also read Harriet Martineau's book, Poor Laws and Paupers Illustrated. But in that book, Martineau characterized the poor as the quote-unquote gangrene of the state. And she was also an advocate of the Poor Law Amendment. And in fact, Lord Chancellor Henry Brougham actually made secret commission reports concerning the Poor Law Amendment available to Martineau. And according to, I believe it's James Moore and I'm drawing a blank on their names. They wrote the James Moore and Adrian Desmond. They wrote the biography of Darwin, simply titled Darwin. And by the way, they themselves are evolutionists. According to them, her book Poor Laws and Paupers Illustrated did more to pave the way for the poor law than all of the government propaganda. And Martineau was also, according to them, a quote-unquote, a darling of the Whigs. And the Whigs was a political party that promoted the Poor Law Amendment Bill. And Martineau basically contended, as did the Whigs, that the reforms that were being presented by the bill would basically encourage a certain degree of self-sufficiency among the poor. But
sort of 19th century welfare reform, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. But her contention was basically bogus. No self-sufficiency could arise from the implementation of that bill, because by immediately thrusting poor, unskilled workers into the job market, the Whigs were actually increasing their profits and decreasing labor costs.
Sort of like leaving the southern border open and allowing all kinds of unskilled labor to come into the country, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so essentially, Martinow was nothing more but a corporate apologist, and she was one of Charles Darwin's dinner guest. And this underscores the point that we endeavor to make in our book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, that Darwinism was not so much a objective scientific theory. And Darwin illustrates a case of what is known as the sociology of scientific knowledge, which basically holds that scientific paradigms are not formulated in a vacuum, but sociological considerations come to bear on a scientist's findings and on a scientist's contentions. And if you look at the individuals that surround Darwin, all of them were technocrats, oligarchs, elitists, aristocrats, racists, and these sort of people informed his worldview. It harkens back to the maxim presented in Miguel de Cervantes' Don Quixote, tell me what company thou keepest, and I'll tell thee what thou art.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, if you look at the company that Darwin kept, you'll know what Darwin was. Darwin was attempting to scientifically legitimize the elitist, technocratic, aristocratic, genocidal, imperialistic worldview of the oligarchs that surrounded him.
And then you connect that dot to what is happening now with the stimulus bill allowing companies to essentially abandon a location and put thousands of people out of work for the sole reason that they can make more money by uprooting and doing it somewhere else and doing it with the taxpayers' dollars.
Right. Well, the deceased Vatican insider by the name of Malachy Martin,
mm-hmm.
in his book, Keys of This Blood, he made a very, very interesting observation. He basically contends that transnationalists, who were basically an outgrowth of the monopolistic capitalist, such as Carnegie and Rockefeller, who, by the way, were heavily influenced by Herbert Spencer. In fact, Herbert Spencer went to a dinner party held by Carnegie and held Carnegie's hand aloft and said, "This is my new American friend," and that symbolized basically the adoption of the monopolistic capitalist Rotter Baron class of social Darwinism and Rockefeller had invoked Darwinian language quite prolifically, talking about survival of the fittest, talking about competition, all the vernacular that came to constitute Darwinism. The irony is, though, is that John D. Rockefeller then proclaimed that competition was a sin.
So, as long as he was already the guy on top, yeah.
That's exactly right.
I mean,
he was only interested in Darwinism insofar as it would legitimize his hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it became clear that natural selection would be no more, forgiving to him than it was to the pauper in the street. Well, then, then he had problems with competition.
I see.
But the transnationalists were an outgrowth of the monopolistic capitalist, transnationalists and their fellow travelers, internationalists, according to Malachy Martin, constituted what he called sociopolitical Darwinians. Sociopolitical Darwinians basically make the same sort of speculative extrapolation that Spencer made, extending the concept of evolution to such sociopolitical arrangements as corporations and nations. And that's precisely what we see being made now, is the same sort of speculative extrapolation. Corporations are basically following evolutionary mandate. They're basically They're basically embracing survival of the fittest. In this instance, the fittest being whoever happens to occupy the higher tiers of the socioeconomic pyramid, so to speak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's precisely what we see with the stimulus package. It is now a game of survival of the richest.
Yeah. It's an excellent article, and it's, as everything Paul and Phil Collins write, thoroughly researched and footnoted so that you can go back and check the source material if you so choose. But they go where the evidence leads and no further, and we'll put a link to the show notes, a link to the article in the show notes, as well as to the archive of articles that they've written at the Conspiracy Archive. You'll find those in the show notes at PIDradio.com. Paul, Phil, want to continue with the article that Paul wrote about the revolution in Iran, but as we're already at the 70-minute mark, I think we'll break this into two parts. Are you guys up for sticking around for another hour?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, it's a fascinating conversation as always, and we will continue with the social upheaval that's taking place inside Iran and whether what America is doing is helping or hurting, and we'll continue. This is A View from the Bunker, and I'm Derek Gilbert.